This podcast is brought to you by Link, simply the best way to learn languages. After you listen to the podcast, sign up for a free account at Link, LINGQ.com, and study the full transcript using Link's revolutionary learning tools.
Hi, Alex.
Hi, Steve.
How are you today?
I'm good.
Good. Well, you know what I would like to talk about today?
What's that?
Well, you know, if the year 2010 was the year of the iPad, to me, because I bought one, I think the year 2011 is going to be the year of, quote, the electronic tablet. Because what I read is that there's just more and more manufacturers coming out with, you know, a similar type product. Have you noticed that?
Oh, of course. They use the term iPad killer very often.
Okay.
Which is the concept of another product trying to take the market share from the iPad.
Right.
So that the iPad then becomes obsolete. But yeah, there's several other manufacturers that are coming out with almost identical devices that perform more or less the same tasks.
And I gather some of them are, they're all trying to take, you know, their own sort of individual approach to it, some larger, some smaller, some with better, I don't know, media. I'm not into all faster or whatever. And of course, when you get people like Samsung and Toshiba and Nokia and all these people get all their technical, you know, whiz kids and experts and stuff developing new and better ways of producing a tablet, I mean, that's going to bring us a lot of competition and should be very interesting. Hopefully it brings the cost of the tablets down eventually. Do you think it will?
I definitely think it will. And I think, well, I'll put it this way. I think the cost of them might stay the same over time, but the features will dramatically improve. And I think that's kind of been, at least for Apple, more or less the historical trend where a laptop computer will cost the same amount, but it will receive more and more updates and upgrades and get better and better. So you're paying the same amount, but it's for a much better product.
But, you know, the interesting thing in all of this is, of course, the rise of places like India and China. It may be that in Europe or North America or Japan or Korea, $500-$600 for some kind of handheld device is okay. Lots of people can afford to spend that kind of money. But I read that the Indians were intent on coming out with some kind of a tablet for around $45. You know, and so if the Chinese and the Indians, and looking at the enormous market potentially in those countries, if they develop products for their market, we could be looking at, they might sacrifice, you know, some functionality, but if they could come up with tablets that do the job, you know, under $100, that's going to be amazing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there was a lot of talk about the $100 laptop.
Right.
And the, I think it was the one child, one laptop per child, OLPC project as well, which was with the intent of providing laptop computers that, you know, were slower but a lot cheaper to manufacture, and providing them to kids in Africa and in different places in the world.
Right. I mean, what I see too is because of my interest in education, I mean, to me, the tablet, the electronic tablet, is absolutely revolutionary, potentially revolutionary, because instead of kids having to buy expensive textbooks, which they carry home in their heavy school bags, or the teachers basically printing out these sheets that look so crummy, you know, that I see my grandchildren take home, and they're still just paper, you know. It's not that big an improvement over what happened 500 years ago. Whereas now, the tablet can enable you to access content anywhere, multimedia content, connect with your friends, have a Skype conversation, video camera conversation. I mean, I think of it for language learning. It basically, to my mind, if the place of learning has been the classroom, my personal view is the place of learning becomes wherever the learner is with the electronic tablet.
Right, and I think that's goes off of the TED Talk by Sugata Mitra, where, you know, he showed the computer that he had put in a slum in India, in rural India, and, or I guess the urban cities as well, and you know, the kids would go there and pretty much teach themselves how to do it, learning without the aid of an instructor or a teacher or any sort of manual, but learning by doing. And I think it makes it even more accessible if there is, in the near future, some sort of product that's manufactured by companies in India or in China for a fraction of the price.
Well, exactly. But of course, if I look at the cost of education, which continues to increase, mm-hmm. you know, every year, 5, 10, 15%, the costs just go up mm-hmm. and the outcomes go down. I was reading that in Canada, we have fewer people graduating from high school than before.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
It's interesting. And so we are investing more and more money. And I mentioned in some discussion, I think, about the book, The Rational Optimist, where mm-hmm. Matt Ridley points out that the cost of just about every product we consume, agricultural products, mm-hmm. you know, consumer products, industrial products, all these costs have gone way down, like a fraction of where they were. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the speed of travel and we're feeding twice as many people and everything has improved except education, which costs more and more mm-hmm. with poorer and poorer outcomes. Mm. Or at least no significant improvement in outcomes.
Right.
And furthermore, the education, which is the largest item in the budget of many countries, mm-hmm. is still targeted primarily at that under 20 age group mm-hmm. between, you know, elementary, high school, and university. Mm-hmm. So they're not even taking that public education budget and spending it on the whole population. Mm-hmm. But we know that we continue to learn throughout our lives.
Yeah.
So I think that the electronic tablet has tremendous potential.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it really opens up the doors for a lot of people to pursue things that previously weren't accessible. I mean, for a working professional,
yeah.
Like I worked in construction, and I saw a lot of guys who were working construction doing, you know, these really terrible blue-collar jobs, and they were stuck in it. You know, they'd been there for 10, 15, 20 years. Some of them are, you know, 40 or 50 years old even, and they simply don't have the option to go back to school. It's simply too expensive for them. They may have families to support and stuff. And so with this, it allows them to, as they're perhaps continuing to do their job, they don't have to take, you know, 2 years off to pursue something different.
Yeah, but I wouldn't necessarily assume that someone in construction is unhappy with their job. I know people who are in construction who are quite happy.
Having been there, there's a fraction of them that actually enjoy it.
Really?
Yeah.
You don't think carpenters enjoy being carpenters?
A lot of them don't, actually.
Really?
I think it's fun initially.
Right.
But it's one of those jobs where if you're not passionate about it,
yeah,
it becomes tedious and it feels like you're not using your potential. Hmm. The reason a lot of people do construction is because it pays well.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason it pays well is because it has a very high turnover rate.
Mm-hmm.
People get hired and fired, like, on the spot.
Mm-hmm.
People cycle through really quickly.
Right.
But it's very difficult work. So,
I mean, I was involved in building for a few years, building homes. And I must say that the morale of the people I worked with was quite high. And obviously, a laborer has a less interesting job, but I thought the carpenters had great pride in their work and enjoyed doing what they were doing.
I think it's
I think the opportunity for someone at age 40 to, you know, retrain to become what, a stockbroker? I mean, you know, he's committed. Like I don't see it so much there. I think, certainly insofar as trades,
mm-hmm.
and I think trades are very important.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not everybody can have a university degree, nor need to have one.
Yeah.
But education, just in terms of self-fulfillment, in terms mm-hmm. of, I don't know, learning languages, you know, there's so many more things that you can do
mm-hmm.
with technology like the iPad, whereas if the model is that you have to go to a classroom mm-hmm. to learn, that's going to eliminate a lot of people right there.
Yeah, and it also increases the cost, because I know that there's a lot of, like, adult programs at universities here where there's night classes and stuff like that, but the costs are really quite significant, you know, for a course that's maybe 2 months long, once a week. It's, you know, $200, $300, $400 even,
mm-hmm.
Which, you know, if you're on a budget, is a right. significant amount of money.
Yeah, and some are a lot more than that mm-hmm. too, depending on whether it's or to what extent it's subsidized by the government.
Right.
So the costs are it's not just the cost that the student pays; it's the cost that the system pays.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I was reading in Canada. I mean, certainly, the amount of money we spend per university student is more than twice what we spend on an elementary or high school student. So there's a lot of money spent on those people.
Yeah.
And as I've said many times, since the vast majority are in the humanities, it's only like 12-15% who are in the hard subjects, you know, engineering, science, and stuff. Mm-hmm. The rest of them are studying gender studies or whatever, history, philosophy. Those are subjects that could be just as easily studied on your own. Just as easily studied on your own. Now, you can argue that it's more fun to go to university. That may be true. But the state is paying for it.
Yeah.
So the state is paying for you to have fun. Well, if you're really interested in the subject, the state should maybe pay for you to have a tablet, an electronic tablet, and go and learn.
Yeah.
Join a group of people who have similar interests. Meet. You know, there's so many other ways of organizing that. So so I believe that the electronic tablet should be a very subversive a very subversive element to our established education bureaucracy.
Yeah.
However, I don't think it'll achieve that because the education bureaucracy is so strongly entrenched and they will somehow try to prevent that from happening because it's in their interest to maintain the model of people coming to the classroom, which is their bread and butter. So, but it's too bad because, I mean, we have seen the in all other fields how modern development, modern inventions, and so forth have led to these phenomenal increases in productivity and reduction in the cost of products, the tremendous range of products. But yeah. But I hope the tablet has that effect.
Yeah. Well, I think, I mean, to put a bit of a different spin on it, I think technology does help the teachers as well. And I know some teachers that I've had where they take advantage of this technology to help provide more relevant information to the students and also provide it in a way that they receive it better. I think it's going to be difficult for something like the electronic tablet to really break down the walls of structured education. But at the same time, there are teachers out there who are willing to take that risk and, you know, try these things out. And, you know, there's countless stories of one teacher in one school with one class of kids who tries something different and has amazing results, you know.
But oh yeah, but to me the I know there are students and the teachers. In fact, I've met teachers. I met a Chinese teacher of Chinese, a lady in her 50s who was using the iPod Touch, had developed programs to help her kids learn characters and was making, you know, excellent use of that technology. But the fundamental problem is that the teacher says, okay, my responsibility is to teach the kids that are in my class or the students in my class in university. So if I am so efficient that they only need one-tenth of my time, then I'm basically, you know, getting rid of my job. Whereas if it were somewhere how structured that my potential market is everybody, everybody that can access the internet.
Yeah.
Like, not just the people who paid to come to this school.
Right.
I'm a good teacher. I know I'm a good teacher. I'm not talking about me, Steve. I'm saying, here's this teacher that says, I'm a good teacher. So rather than saying, and I know that with the use of this technology, you know, one-tenth of the input of my time can generate like 10 times the amount of learning if I use this technology.
Right.
But as long as my market base, customer base is fixed, all I'm doing is reducing my work. So that's not so good.
Yeah.
So there needs to be some kind of an image of the market that enables the teacher to say, my market is the world. Now, how can I use this platform to get my ideas and my better ways of teaching out to not only the people who sit in my classroom, but to everybody?
Yeah.
So that's what, so that the ultimate, right now, the marketplace for any education technology is the school system or the university. It's, it seems to be more those people who have a vested interest in the present structure. What has to happen is for the teacher has to become an entrepreneur. The teacher as a promoter, as an entrepreneur, promoting learning, promoting an interest in his subject, mm-hmm. and promoting and showing people how to learn using the technology. But then the market has to be everybody, regardless of their age, regardless of where they are. There's right. no reason why someone who teaches at UBC should mm-hmm. be limited to the people who manage to get on a bus or drive or bicycle to UBC mm-hmm. here in Vancouver. Mm-hmm. There's no reason why someone in Mongolia shouldn't right. be taking advantage, or conversely, someone in Vancouver who likes the professor in Mongolia should be studying, you know, with him or yeah. her yeah. as a professor. So that, to me, would be potentially
ideal.
Ideal with if, but you got to break down so many walls.
Yeah.
For that to happen.
Yeah. Sounds
anyway.
Good.
Anyway,
it would be
we'll
cool.
We'll see. But I think there will be an explosion of these tablets.
Mm-hmm.
And when they first came out, people were saying, well, what are they good for? You know, there's just like, it's neither a phone nor a computer. And
yeah.
all of this skepticism, in fact, it's continuing to pick up steam.
Mm-hmm. It is, yeah.
yeah.
And there, I just read recently that Apple has actually ordered an increase on the production of iPads,
mm-hmm.
the new iPad 2, which has not yet been announced, but
right.
A lot of people are anticipating that, so... It'll
yeah.
be interesting to see where it goes in the next few months and
it's,
in the next few years.
It's really fascinating.
Yeah.
Well, I guess that was our main... we had a whole bunch of other things we could talk about, but we decided to focus in on that. So
mm-hmm.
2011, the year of the tablet. I wonder how many of our listeners have an
mm-hmm.
electronic tablet.
It would be interesting to hear.
Yeah, let us know, or if you want us to talk about something else,
mm-hmm.
please let us know.
Yeah.
Okay. By the way, I had a Skype message from someone in Brazil who said
mm-hmm.
something to the effect of, you know, when are we going to have another podcast? And Alex rocks or something like that. Something. He's a fan.
Oh,
he's
thank
fan.
You.
There
thank
you go.
That's good to hear.
Okay.
Cool.
Thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening, everyone.
Bye.
Take care.